This is The Best of Our Knowledge, a presentation of National Productions.
Over the years, we've heard about the fight against big oil and big tobacco and everyone's favorite, big government. Well, now we're hearing about big data. Companies are using your data to sell you stuff, but scientists are using it in other ways.
So if big data can be used to predict something like consumer behavior, then it's certainly exciting to try and apply the same techniques to predict the outcome of disease.
Today on The Best of Our Knowledge, a discussion on how clinical scientists are using big data. We'll also hear how fertility treatments have worked miracles for women and couples trying to have children, but those treatments have also opened up other doors, including the ability to manipulate genes and, quote, build a better baby. And we'll spend an academic minute using another state-of-the-art tool for fighting disease, fruit flies. I'm Bob Barrett, and this is The Best of Our Knowledge. Big data now seems to be everywhere. Google searches are being used to predict flu outbreaks, and airline statistics are being mined to determine the best hour of which day to book plane tickets. Science also can benefit from these trends. Given the emerging importance of reproducible data analysis pipelines, one could think of a special group of trained, quote, big data experts that could be available to regulatory agencies and to clinical laboratories for review and auditing of their processes and practices, and who may be able to offer suggestions for improvements. That's the topic of an article from the February 2015 issue of the journal Clinical Chemistry titled Learning from Our Mistakes: The Future of Validating Complex Diagnostics. The lead author of that opinion piece is Dr. Stephen Master, Chief of Clinical Chemistry and Director of the Central Laboratory at the Weill Cornell Medical Center in New York City, where he also serves as a member of their Institute for Precision Medicine. I asked Dr. Master to first simply tell us, just what is big data?
Well, big data is a term that really reflects a fairly recent and rapid increase in the pure amount of information that's being collected. And specifically, it's being collected in a way that can be easily analyzed using computational tools. So maybe the most well-known example of big data comes from companies like Google or Amazon or Netflix, who can use the data that they gather to predict what you'll want to see or buy. So in the case of Amazon, for example, when you see the books that are recommended for you, that list has been produced by an algorithm based on what Amazon knows about you and your shopping habits, as well as on the aggregated shopping habits of a much larger customer base. Or in the case of Google, the information that's available from your search history or your Gmail or whatever else Google knows about you can be computationally analyzed using machine learning approaches and used to predict what ads you should be shown. So at the commercial level, big data approaches have been extremely powerful. So if big data can be used to predict something like consumer behavior, then it's certainly exciting to try and apply the same techniques to predict the outcome of disease and to provide better patient care. I think it's probably worth highlighting at least two ways in which this is happening. The first is that as electronic medical records improve, a number of groups are trying to use big data strategies to learn about statistical relationships that will help to guide medical management of patients. And of course, the data that are generated from the clinical lab are in many ways perfect for this application, since they already exist often in a numeric form that can be easily adapted for the kinds of data mining purposes we care about. So that's one fairly obvious and potentially powerful way to apply big data in medical care. The second way is also interesting, though, because it shows that the big data that are useful to predict disease can sometimes come from unexpected places. So in 2009, a group from Google published a paper in Nature in which they showed that they could predict influenza outbreaks in the U.S. by tracking search terms that Google gathered. At first glance, this doesn't seem like medical data, but it turned out that this project, which was called Google Flu Trends, was able to provide accurate results 1 to 2 weeks earlier than the CDC. So it held out the prospect of significant public health benefit.
What do you think that initiatives like the Google Flu Trends project can teach us about testing in the clinical lab?
Well, on the one hand, as I've indicated, Google Flu Trends was a great example of using big data in healthcare. Google's process, which included mining 50 million search terms in an unguided way and coming up with a predictive diagnostic, is a great example of how machine learning can work. And those of us in the clinical lab, who also increasingly manage large data sets, coming from both the fact that we see large numbers of patients and also from the fact that we measure more and more things about those patients, and you can just think, for example, of the marked increase in data that have come from the widespread adoption of genomic testing, for example. So when you think about the analogy between, say, Google and the clinical lab, you can see why there's a lot of excitement about using similar algorithms to analyze lab data. Now, I should say, though, that there's a catch. The flip side of the story is that although Google Flu Trends did a great job in the 2007-2008 flu season, by 2012 it was not performing as well. It turns out that changes in the usage of terms by Google's users, among other things, were leading to poorer performance. So when Google went back and incorporated data from 2010 and 2011 into their model, their 2012 predictions improved. Okay, so what does this tell us about the clinical lab? Well, we face an analogous situation, as you know. For example, when treatments change or patient populations change, it may be that we'll see changes in the performance of complex algorithms that we may develop for diagnostics. So in this article, we argue that it is very important not to lock ourselves into static models, but rather to build in statistical approaches, such as Bayesian statistical approaches, for example, that can be dynamically refined over time. And this is what we mean by learning from our mistakes.
The March 2014 issue of Science had an article that stated that Google was guilty of big data hubris. What do you think of that?
Well, as I said, there are a number of things that have been noted about Google Flu Trends subsequent to its original publication in 2009. Some of that had to do with the problems that arose from not incorporating the 2010-2011 search term changes. And so certainly one could take this too far and say that Google has decided that they can predict the entire world simply based on search terms. But nonetheless, it is the case that Google Flu Trends does a remarkable job at predicting the flu, given the caveats about retraining the algorithm. And that's really one of the things that was an impetus for us writing this article, was to say that in the same way, we don't want to be caught in the clinical laboratory community with static algorithms that do not reflect changes that occur in our underlying patient populations or in their underlying treatment.
What are some of the risks involved in using complex algorithms to interpret laboratory data?
Well, the main difficulty with using complex algorithms is that they can hide many other mistakes in medical research, whether those are errors in study design or problems with pre-analytical variation or issues with the data management itself. There have been a number of examples over the last decade or so where complex biological data have been interpreted using an algorithm in a way that is just frankly incorrect, we now know. And there's at least one publicized case in which this led to patients being placed into inappropriate arms of a clinical oncology trial. So clearly this is something that needs to be very carefully considered. So how can we address this? One solution has been to try and understand the underlying biology that drives the algorithm. Another strategy has been to make sure that there's appropriate regulatory oversight, and this is certainly something that the FDA, for example, has been very aware of. Now, a third response came from what was really a landmark report released in 2012 by the Institute of Medicine that recommended that these kinds of complex algorithms, specifically when applied to omics assays such as genomics, proteomics, or metabolomics, should be completely specified in a final form prior to rigorous clinical testing in order to ensure that their behavior is well understood.
Now finally, Doctor, you mentioned earlier that Google Flu Trends demonstrated the value of moving beyond static models. Would this approach have any implications for the way that diagnostic tests are regulated?
Yes, I'm very glad you brought that up. In this paper, we argued that one lesson of Google Flu Trends is that you can't just mine big data, create a great algorithm, and then stop. But as treatment paradigms or patient populations change, it will be necessary to update our models based on new data that comes in. Now, the way that we as a field currently handle this from a regulatory perspective is to say, you've created an assay with a static diagnostic algorithm. We've tested that static algorithm. And if things stop working down the road, then we'll start the process all over again. What we're proposing is an alternative where we say that it's possible to learn from our mistakes using a more dynamic approach while still being rigorous using tools such as Bayesian statistics to continually update our algorithms based on new data that we receive. But of course, this raises the critical question, if laboratories start building dynamic analyses into complex data, do that into their diagnostics, how can a consumer of data or regulatory agency know that the results are reliable and clinically valid? And this is obviously very important since we do not want to propose any changes that would put the field at the risk of some of the problems of the last 10 to 15 years. We do think that there is an answer, though, which is to rigorously validate the dynamic updating process itself. So rather than saying that we approve a fixed algorithm with fixed parameters, we might envision a regulatory approval of a well-defined data gathering process that is used to alter the algorithm in a specified, statistically valid way. In fact, my co-author has proposed that there would be a role for specially trained big data experts that we could call algorithmists who would be able to review and audit and validate these types of approaches for the laboratory and for regulatory agencies. So we do think that there are ways to more efficiently have our diagnostic algorithms learn from their mistakes in a way that maintains the safety and validity of laboratory testing.
Dr. Stephen Master is Chief of Clinical Chemistry and Director of the Central Laboratory at the Weill Cornell Medical Center in New York City. Still to come, clinical laboratories can use genetics to screen for disease before birth. But should they? That's next on The Best of Our Knowledge. Got any questions or comments about The Best of Our Knowledge? Send them in. Our email address is knowledge@wamc.org. And if you'd like to listen to this or any past programs again, you can find them online at our flagship station's website. Just go to wamc.org and click on the programs link. And while you're there, subscribe to The Best of Our Knowledge's podcast or download the WAMC radio app to listen on demand anytime, anyplace. This is The Best of Our Knowledge. I'm Bob Barrett. The development of in vitro fertilization in the 1970s revolutionized the treatment of infertility. However, the ability to culture embryos has also allowed for the development of pre-implantation genetic diagnosis, or PGD. PGD involves removing a cell from a developing embryo for genetic testing before choosing one to transfer into the mother. Just like prenatal diagnosis, it's used to screen for various genetic diseases before birth. Last January, we discussed this topic with Dr. Anne Granowski, who's professor in the Department of Pathology and Immunology at Washington University School of Medicine, and bioethicist Dr. Arthur Kaplan, the head of the Division of Bioethics at New York University Medical Center in New York City. With our discussion of big data, it seems like a good time to revisit this topic. I asked Dr. Granowski why she thinks the ethics of pre-implantation genetics is so important.
The ability to perform pre-implantation genetics has great power. It allows us to eliminate embryos that have unwanted traits and select for embryos that have what we consider as desirable traits, right? So with this great power comes great responsibility. So as the molecular biology techniques continue to advance, we continue to expand the number of traits that we can screen for. And so it begs the question of what is acceptable to screen for. So are there lines that should be drawn? In other words, are there traits for which we should not allow screening? And I think that we need to ask these questions before we develop screening methods.
Are there examples of pre-implantation genetic testing that have raised ethical questions?
Yes. So, for instance, pre-implantation genetics has been used to select for preferred sex. And in some cases, that's to avoid a disease that's carried by a particular sex. But other times, it's done for so-called family planning or gender balance. In other words, selecting a gender because of preference. Now, in other cases, embryos have been tested so that the resulting child would be compatible to serve as a stem cell donor for a sick sibling. And in other controversial cases, there's been actually selection of affected embryos so that the child has the same minor disability, such as deafness or dwarfism, as the parents. Some pre-implantation genetic laboratories agree to do this type of testing, and some do not.
Well, what are some of the concerns for the future?
Well, as we discover the genetic basis for various phenotypic traits, and as genetic testing becomes easier and cheaper and faster, some people are concerned that it will be easier to screen for non-medical-based traits. So these include traits such as height or intelligence or beauty or sexual orientation. All of these traits are influenced by our individual social values, and some worry that this is a slippery slope, really, to tread on. Some of the concern is centered on the fact that there's not enough effective oversight of the development and use of such testing. So, again, I think it's useful to have these kinds of discussions before testing for these kinds of traits become feasible.
Thanks, Doctor. Now let's turn to bioethicist Dr. Arthur Kaplan. Doctor, as an ethicist, do you believe that pre-implantation genetic diagnosis should be limited to persons who are infertile or those who are fertile but may transmit grave genetic disorders to their children? Or do you consider that it can be used more broadly?
I would limit it now primarily because the ability to be accurate in the testing is not quite to the point where we could say, if I wanted to pick a child with certain traits, whatever those might be, I can actually, if you will, guarantee that that child's going to possess those traits. We're not quite there yet. And morally, it seems to me, in a situation where we're trying to constrain medical resources, using PGD for purposes other than disease avoidance or trying to identify conditions that might be treatable if you act quickly at birth, it's hard to justify doing more than that right now.
Is it okay to want to create better babies, or does that come too close to eugenics?
Well, it certainly is eugenics when one says, I want to build a better baby. And I think for some properties and traits, it might make sense to say, if we give this child a little bit more memory or a little bit more musical ability, maybe even a little more general intelligence, that might be a good thing. Enhancing capacities and abilities would be good. But if you're pursuing those goals and there are risks, meaning if the parents are disappointed because something else still goes wrong and they get a child who is not what they dreamed of, are they going to reject the child? Are they going to make life miserable for the child? And remember, too, in trying to pursue better babies, the definition of better is very much in the eye of the beholder. What one group would say is important to them, maybe intellectual performance. Another group might be more concerned about physical performance. And I'm not sure we can actually draw a hard and fast line to say, we all agree that that trait is better. So while we try to understand, if you will, what constitutes disease, are we going to try and do something about albinism, which is a disorder in many parts of the world that people despise and hate and think is a curse, but in the U.S. and other countries is not even really treated as a problem. You just wear your sunscreen and a hat. It seems to me we've got enough difficulty right now figuring out what's a disorder and a disease. We're not yet ready to go down the road of trying to figure out what's better and best.
In general, what types of genes do you feel should be tested for?
At present, I don't think we should be testing unless we've got very high degrees of accuracy, very low rates of false positives for diseases that are clearly disabling or cause death. In other words, right now, I think we should be conservative with PGD. If you're looking at someone who's likely to inherit hemophilia, if someone's going to have Fanconi's anemia, if someone's going to inherit Huntington's disease, there are major categories where broad consensus exists that these are either likely to cause death or going to be very, very disabling and incapacitating. There are some borderline issues around deafness, blindness, and other conditions where I think there is dispute, and we might even give some leeway there, even though there isn't consensus that being born deaf is worthy of trying to avoid it and honor parents' wishes who don't want that to happen, because it's not that disabling. But I think that's where we should be at present. Going further right now without much more accurate testing, much better counseling, and much more societal debate about what's better and best, I think is premature.
Well, who do you think should pay the cost of doing PGD?
If you're in a situation where you're trying to avoid clear-cut diseases and disorders that everyone would agree are just terribly burdensome on the person, then I think the public programs, government insurance, or private insurance should cover those things. When you move into the more eugenic-type goals, saying I want to enhance, improve, make the better baby, I don't think government funds should be there. That should be something that, when it happens, people should have to pay out of pocket. I don't think that society can move toward trying to use public money to improve children, improve the makeup of the human species until it really is able to say we've done everything we can to eliminate disease and disorder. We're not close to that yet, so moving over to the pursuit of improvement when so many people around the world still have to struggle with desperate life-threatening conditions and terribly disabling problems, I don't think that's the right moral priority.
And I understand that some parents want to choose embryos that have a defect so that their children can be like them. From an ethical standpoint, do you think this should be allowed?
So I have encountered situations where someone has said, you know, I want to use PGD, but I'd like to use it so that a person inherits, let's say, small stature. We're small and we want a child that's like us. Or someone else might say, we're deaf due to a hereditary condition. Pick out an embryo that will also be deaf because we'd like to have children like us. My point of view on this is medicine shouldn't contribute to the creation of children knowing that they're going to lack function or lack impairment that might be viewed as normal. So I would oppose the use of PGD. I understand parents might want that. I understand they might have wishes to form a continuity or a bond between themselves and their children, but I don't think medical skills should be used to make anyone worse off. I think that's a misuse of the testing. It's not a path I would see those who can do PGD pursuing. That said, I certainly do know of instances where doctors have done that and honored the wishes of a couple to say, make a child like us. I don't think it's right, but it does happen.
Dr. Ann Granowski is professor in the Department of Pathology and Immunology at Washington University School of Medicine. And bioethicist Dr. Arthur Kaplan is the head of the Division of Bioethics at New York University Medical Center in New York City. You can read more about this topic in the January 2014 issue of the journal Clinical Chemistry. Sure, you can fight disease with big data or state-of-the-art genetics, or you can just use fruit flies. That's the topic of today's Academic Minute.
Fruit flies can be annoying pests, but they may hold the key to treating disease. I'm Dr. Lynn Pascarella, president of Mount Holyoke College, and today on the Academic Minute, Michelle Markstein, assistant professor of biology at the University of Massachusetts Amherst, is modifying genes in fruit flies to help hone chemotherapy treatments.
Chances are you haven't given much thought to fruit flies. If asked, you might conjure a picture of them hovering over rotting bananas, perhaps even in your own kitchen. You probably would not imagine flies helping to find new drugs to fight cancer. But that's exactly what we are doing with flies in my lab. Humbling as it may be, on a molecular level, flies don't look that different from us. They have many of the same genes and many of the same cell types. Now, the flies in your kitchen don't naturally have cancer. But in the lab, we can genetically modify them with human genes, causing them to grow tumors of different sizes. In a recent paper, we showed that expressing the human RAF oncogene, a cancer-causing gene, in fly stem cells causes flies to grow tumors. Importantly, we showed that these tumors shrank when flies ingested FDA-approved chemotherapy drugs. This is exciting because it suggests that if we find new drugs that shrink tumors in flies, they might also work in people. On the flip side, our results also point to a side effect of chemotherapy drugs in flies that may likewise apply to us. Specifically, we found that cells in the fly intestine respond to some chemotherapy drugs by secreting growth factors related to human IL-6 cytokines, which activate the inflammation pathway. In flies, this drives stem cells in the intestine to hyperproliferate, which is one of the early hallmarks of cancer. The good news is that our discovery of this side effect provides a new opportunity to improve chemotherapy. Indeed, we are now using flies to find drugs that can block side effects in the stem cell microenvironment. So next time you see fruit flies buzzing about your kitchen, don't think of them as mere pests. They may help save lives someday.
That was Michelle Markstein of the University of Massachusetts Amherst. You can find this, other segments, and more information about the professors at academicminute.org.
Production support for the Academic Minute comes from Newman's Own Foundation in partnership with Mount Holyoke College. That's all the time we have for this week's program. If you'd like to listen again, join us online at our flagship station's website. Go to wamc.org and click on the programs link. And while you're there, subscribe to our podcast or any of the other National Productions podcasts. And if you have any questions or comments about the program, send them in. Our email address is knowledge@wamc.org. I'm Bob Barrett. Be sure to join us next time for another edition of The Best of Our Knowledge.
Bob Barrett is producer of The Best of Our Knowledge. Dr. Alan Chartok is executive producer. The Best of Our Knowledge is a production of WAMC Radio's National Productions, which is solely responsible for its content. Hear more at wamc.org.